Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
رامزديل ماذا فعلت يا رامزديل؟ تشاكا استرجعها تلعب هنالك مع إيميل سميث. الكرة البعيدة البحث عن أوباميون كرة ممتازة روهرب 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 ومازال إيميل سميث هاي ديرة التسديدة با 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 جول أوباميون جول رامزديل
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gutterblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm okay. We've overcome some technical jiggery pokery right there, where everything that's been working fine for years, that, you know, changes. People make changes to things, and they do so because I guess they're thinking, we'll improve it. But I like things staying the way they are when they work just fine. So
yes, to hell with progress.
Well, yes, in some aspects, certainly there are things where I think progress is necessary, but other things you just leave well enough alone and it's okay. And it was working fine. And now I'm going to have to figure out how to work it, because at some point the new version will become the default version and you can't use the old version. This is all very exciting stuff for our listeners, I'm sure.
Yes, but, you know, we're here. That's the important
thing. That is the important thing. How is your interlol going?
It's fine. It's uneventful, I have to be honest with you. I've not been paying a great deal of attention to the international football. I didn't even watch the England game, really. They played Andorra. And I didn't get sucked into the Nations League final. I couldn't quite find it in myself.
I thought it was amazing last night when I discovered that there was is it an international tournament? Can we really call it an international tournament? Technically it is, with a final between, who was it, France and Spain?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a tasty game.
Yeah, and there were semi-finals earlier in the week. I actually did see a bit of the Belgium-France semi-final, which was a really entertaining game. I think 3-2 to France right at the end. But, yeah, a tasty-looking fixture.
What do they win? I mean, look, yeah, tasty-looking fixture that I looked at and went, but I genuinely could not give a single fuck about this, because what do they win in this Nations
League? I think they get into the Champions League. I think Didier Deschamps will lead France into the Champions League next season, the holy grail of European football. I think they just get a little trophy.
A plaque.
And maybe like a, not a star on their kit, but like, I don't know, an asterisk, you know, some sort of little symbol, a hashtag.
Hashtag Nations League 21.
Yeah, embroidered all across the back. I don't know, England got to the semi-finals last time round and then went out. I mean, it's a curious competition. I suppose what I would say is I probably prefer it to sort of the sheer pointlessness of friendlies. But
what, like playing Andorra?
Well, I mean, that's the World Cup qualification.
Oh, right. So, yeah. What's the difference?
Who knows? I mean, England's World Cup qualifying group is quite mad. I think they've got Andorra and the Faroe Islands in the group. So, it's thrill-a-minute stuff.
Mm.
But you know, Bukayo Saka scored.
He did. That's good.
Saw that.
That's good. I'm glad when he scores. Are you in any way heartened by the fact that he was able to play 90 minutes for England, because we saw him towards the end of the Brighton game go down with a bit of an injury, and then there was nothing more said about it, so I figure there was nothing else going on right there, but
Yeah, Arteta did say one thing after the game where he said he's fine, basically. He said, you know, it's not a serious problem. So I always suspected he was likely to go away with England. And I think he's now scored in consecutive England games. First Arsenal player to do that for a long time.
Who was the last one?
I don't know, actually. But I remember seeing a tweet from, like, Albino or Opta, you know, one of these accounts that made me think, oh, that is a little while.
Who could it have been? Ian Wright? Alan Smith?
Yeah. He's the youngest player to score in consecutive appearances for the England men's team since Wayne Rooney in 2004, and the youngest ever Arsenal player to net in consecutive games for England. But it doesn't say who the last is. It has to be Ian Wright, doesn't it?
I think so. I'm trying to think of who else it could possibly be.
Merson, maybe, or Parler. But I think let's take a stab at Ian Wright.
Yeah, okay.
So he scored. That was nice. Thomas Partey scored a goal all of his own making, won the ball on the left-hand side, drove in field, and put it in the corner, like in the net, in between the posts and everything.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. He's got a good goal-scoring record at international level, it seems.
He has.
I think it was Charles Watts who did a tweet that said it's something like 11 goals in 33 appearances.
It's about 1 in 3 or something like that, yeah. Which is pretty impressive.
It is. Are you surprised that he has so few caps? It seems like a low number of caps, doesn't it? Only 30 or thereabouts.
Is that right? Mm. Yeah, it does seem really low. I'm suspicious of that.
Well, transfermarkt.co.uk says he's made 28 appearances for Ghana.
Wikipedia 31 says 32.
And all, yeah. So they're about 30-ish. 30
for a 28-year-old who's been around a long time, you know, sort of broke into the Atletico Madrid team in like 2015 kind of time. I mean, that's you'd expect more.
Yeah, he made his debut in 2016. Aged 22 years, 11 months, and 23 days. That's the info that I have right here in front of me. So, but look, the main thing is the goal. So are you hoping now that when he returns to Arsenal, he'll be full of goal-scoring spunk, if you like?
I think this is... Wow, what an image. I think this is the start of a hot streak. A Joe Willock-style hot streak. He's going to score in every game between now and the end of the season.
And then we'll sell him to Newcastle because they've got so much money.
There you go. We sold Joe Willock too soon. That's what I've realised this week. We'd only held on till now.
I saw people say that, but then chances are they might have set their sights elsewhere if they hadn't already got Joe. I know. So look, I mean, we should maybe chat a little bit about this Newcastle thing and how it's all played out over the last few days. What are your overreaching thoughts on, I don't know, what way do you approach it? Like, can you talk about what it means for the Premier League, what it might mean for Newcastle, what it might mean for Arsenal, what it means about football in general? I don't know exactly where to begin with this one.
Well, many listeners have sort of got in touch to flag the kind of dubious, the sort of moral and ethical concerns over a team nicknamed the Magpies having access to that sort of money.
Yeah, I saw one on the Discord. DJ Rad B said, should we hate Newcastle considering they are, after all, Magpies? And now extremely dubiously wealthy Magpies at that.
We've always known on this podcast that Magpies were a threat. And in fact, if anything, in football terms, that hasn't always played out. Newcastle looked relatively safe. But now that's all changed. That the prophecy has come true. The Magpies are here to take us.
They are. They're going to take everyone out. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see how it plays out. Look, I mean, we did have questions about it. So given this is an interlol Arscast extra, we might do questions in both halves of the show to give us some talking points as we go along. So, again, from the Discord, Emil Smith Row Your Boat says, there is an almost unsustainable amount of cognitive dissonance that goes into being a fan of top flight football. Clubs are bought by ever richer billionaires, or in some cases, human rights abusing states using the game as a PR vehicle. The governing bodies seek only to enrich themselves further as they allow the sport to be used by charlatans and intervene solely when their slice of the pie is being threatened. Can you envisage a point where enough is enough with elite sport for either of you guys? Alternatively, do you think it's more likely that football will eat its own face to the point where it comes crashing down, or can these people rely on a never-ending stream of new fans to sell this product to? Nice, easy question to get us going today.
Wow. I mean, I do think there probably is no sport or no sporting competition that has quite sold itself, in brackets, sold itself out, in the manner of the Premier League. Like, I don't think it's rivaled in terms of that, in terms of its sort of either, I guess, its capacity to generate revenue, but also its capacity to kind of chase or welcome money in any avenue possible.
Mm.
And so the point is right. There is a huge amount of cognitive dissonance required. In a funny way, like, like for a lot of people, this Saudi Arabia interest in Newcastle, well, this takeover, may be a kind of, to borrow a phrase from your excellent blog last week, a straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm.
But it's also just like another straw. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a big straw.
Very big.
But it's also just another straw. It's kind of like, it makes you reflect on it and it makes you think about it, but ultimately it doesn't feel like the situation is drastically different to what it was the day before. I kind of feel as distanced and disenchanted as I did before the takeover, you know?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's one of these things where whatever angle you come at it from, there's a talking point, or, you know, I thought there was a great podcast. I know many people here will listen to Second Captains. I think it was one of their paywall podcasts on Patreon with James Montague, who wrote the Billionaires book about, you know, football's owners. I think it was The Unstoppable Rise of Football's Super Rich Owners. A really great book. And I interviewed James on the Arscast a couple of years ago about that book. But he was talking on that podcast about, you know, there is no difference between the Saudi state and this, you know, this fund that apparently is the one that's fronting up to buy Newcastle United. This is the Saudi state. You know, I'm trying to learn a bit more about this. I'm reading a book about MBS at the moment. So that's eye-opening in its own way. It does feel like a bit seismic though, or something, because I don't know, so much of it just does not stand up to any kind of scrutiny. Like, this was a takeover that was prohibited or banned. And then there's, you know, MBS texting Boris Johnson to have a word. And then this piracy issue, which seems to have been the main stumbling block. Because, the beIN Sport versus the Saudi piracy thing that was going on. As soon as that was sorted, this thing has gone through. And it's just, as I've said, you know, on the blog and on the podcast on Friday, almost an inevitability based on the way football has been run and the way football has, like you say, sold itself or sold its soul or will sell any part of itself without thinking about, you know, what it means in the wider context beyond, like, we've got a rich owner now, we can buy good players, and chances are, in a couple of years' time, Newcastle, given the wealth that they have, are going to be a team which is enjoying a lot of success, because that's what happens when owners with a different level of wealth come in and just plough money into the thing. Now, they've got to do it in a smart way. I think what you could say about whatever you think about Chelsea, you know, they put in place a system or a structure that really works for them. You know what I mean? Everyone, you know the way people were like, well, they don't give managers any time. It's terrible. You know, they don't give, it's like, well, they just fire them and then bring in a new guy to win some shit. And when that doesn't really work, they just fire him and bring in another guy to win some shit. So from that perspective, it works. Man City, you know, they brought in these guys from Barcelona, if you remember, these executives. I don't know if there's any correlation between their arrival at Man City and Barcelona's decline, but, you know, they put in place very, very smart footballing practices and structures at Man City and the City Group, et cetera, et cetera. So, but each one of them had more wealth than the other. So Abramovich came in, had more wealth than anybody else in the Premier League. Chelsea became a powerhouse. Man City's owners came in, had more wealth than Abramovich, became a powerhouse. And it's impossible not to think that unless the people who run Newcastle are ridiculously inept or stupid, that they're not going to be a Premier League powerhouse. And that is something that we are going to have to contend with over the coming years.
Yeah, I think, you know, in general, money wins in the Premier League. And, if you look at kind of the salary bill against the league table over time, there's a clear trend and a clear sort of connectivity between those two things, a correlation. I think it will. And it's, you know, while I say the Premier League had already sold itself out, don't get me wrong, there is still stuff about this particular takeover that does trouble me. Like, I admit a certain degree of cultural bias is possible, but the kind of human rights component here, like around the Saudi state, it does make me feel deeply uncomfortable. And that's not, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I appreciate most billionaires are in some way problematic, but I think there are degrees.
Sure.
And I feel like this stuff is particularly bad. But in the interest of levity, this tweet really made me laugh. I don't know if you saw this, but Alex Thompson, who's a Newcastle fan, this is not funny, tweeted, "As a lifelong Newcastle United supporter, I feel sick this morning. No time for Ashley, but he doesn't murder and dismember journalists or chop people's heads off or treat women as third-class humans on an industrial scale. What the hell has football become?" And then this guy replied to him saying, "Have a day off, will ya? It's just where football is these days. Not everything has to be PC," which I think is the most extraordinary use of PC, meaning politically correct, I've ever heard. The idea that thinking that not beheading people is just political correctness really made me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so woke, isn't it? You know,
and I'm sick of these people.
Yeah, I'm sick of them.
And their anti-beheading agenda. Take a day off, will you, mate?
It is. I mean, this is the thing, though. I mean, I think I read a piece this morning in The Athletic. It was a good piece from Jack Pitt-Brook, who was talking about the reaction of fans, you know? And I think if an owner came into a football club that had a track record of human rights abuse or intolerance or, you know, criminalizing, gay people or whatever it might be, that you know, we would like to speak out about it and say something about it. And there's this weird conflation between, let's say, the club and the team. You can support the team and you want the team to do well, but you can have issues and take issue with the way that the club is run or the people who own the club, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, it's
interesting. When Alisher Usmanov first began expressing interest in Arsenal, there were certain sort of allegations around his conduct and his behaviour that surfaced. And I remember, at least anecdotally, a lot of Arsenal fans voicing opposition to his potential ownership on that basis. What's interesting is that was now quite a long time ago. Like, that was now, I don't know,
2006, 2007.
Yeah, something like that.
A bit more.
And I wonder if the same reservations would be in place now. You'd like to think so, but it's kind of like the like I say, like football is sort of eating itself at this point. Mm. And a lot of fans may just feel that slightly depressing thing of if you can't beat them, join them, you know, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that sense because, A, they just wanted to get rid of Mike Ashley. So anybody coming in who wasn't Mike Ashley was good. And
absolutely.
When that person who's coming in has got $300 billion to their name, that's even better.
I think if Newcastle had been taken over by a bloke who had like a tenner in his back pocket, they'd probably be dancing in the streets. They hated Mike Ashley that much. Like, I do think that's worth saying.
Mm.
This is very much about Mike Ashley as well, in defence of the Newcastle.
Yeah, and look, I don't think some of the reaction of... I'm not going to generalise or anything like that, but I did see one particular statement from basically the Newcastle version of Gay Gooners, which I thought was a really, really... They really let them off the hook in that statement when they could, when they could have made a really strong statement about, you know, what their stance was regarding the criminality of homosexuality and et cetera, it just felt like it was just supplicant in a way, and that's really a shame. And your day to day Newcastle fan, you know, why wouldn't they be pleased that they've got rid of a terrible owner and they've got an owner who's going to come in and potentially make them one of the biggest clubs in the world? It's not on the fans, I don't think, to be the moral arbiters of football when football has already gone way too far down the line of, you know, the kind of ownership that we're seeing. I mean, it's impossible as well not to think about, well, what if this was Arsenal? What if it had happened, you know, that... Look, the Cronkies aren't the most popular owners in the world. Perhaps not quite at the level of Mike Ashley. But, like, there would be a very sizable majority of Arsenal fans who would like to see new ownership.
Mm.
What would the reaction have been like if it were the Saudi fund buying Arsenal? It's one of those, you know, you can't say for sure, but there would be people who would be just delighted about it. There would be people who would have objections, but, you know, I think it's just part and parcel of the way football is right now, that they've created this environment in which the only way you can compete is to have an ever richer, ever more powerful, ever more whatever owner. That's the only way you can compete. So why would fans not embrace that?
Yeah, well, especially when it feels like it's so out of their control. I mean, ultimately, fans don't determine who owns the club. They can try.
Mm.
Newcastle fans have tried many times. They couldn't be more clear in their opposition to Mike Ashley. You know, Arsenal fans have asked for Kroenke out, but it's not something within their power to do. So when something like this happens, I can understand how, as a fan, you sort of go, well, I can't, you know, change that. That's the market. That's how this has played out. You know, my interest is in what happens on the pitch, and it's possible to find reasons for optimism in that. It's really complex, and I have to be honest, like, I do see it through the prism of an Arsenal fan, and I think about the implications for my own club, my own team. It makes me reflect on my relationship with our owners as well. It's just one of those moments that sort of brings everything into focus. You know, you can't help but kind of take stock when something, as you said, as seismic as this takes place.
What do you make? There was a story in The Guardian over the weekend, you know, where the other 19 Premier League clubs were furious, apparently, about this takeover going through. And you can understand why they might be furious, because when somebody comes along with those kind of resources, how much they're going to put into Newcastle, we'll wait and see. But it dwarfs, it literally dwarfs anything else that exists in the Premier League. So I can understand why certain clubs might be furious or scared or worried about, you know, how this is going to affect them. But, I mean, how does Manchester City or Chelsea in any good conscience object to something like this happening when this is just exactly what they did, but on a different scale because of the level of wealth?
But football clubs do this all the time. They're always trying to pull up the drawbridge, you know?
Yeah,
they're always
trying to
protect, the power that they have accumulated. And, you know, it's partly what happened with financial fair play. Once everyone had gotten their foot in the door, they were like, right, we better have rules now to stop this happening in future. Or indeed with the Super League.
Mm.
Well, we're the big six, so let's close that off now. And we'll just rake in that revenue if that's all right with everyone else. Turned out it wasn't. Mm. But... I that doesn't surprise me in the least, to be honest. It's a weirdly... because most of these owners want the same things, you know, particularly, I guess, the American owners. The owners, let's say, who are looking at it from a business perspective rather than a kind of state sports washing perspective, they're looking for big revenues and they want to guarantee those revenues. And so... the self-preservation element is obvious there. What makes, from a competitive point of view, Newcastle, like Manchester City, such an ominous presence for Arsenal and other teams in the Premier League is that the revenues presumably won't really matter to them. It will be, you know, about winning. It's this sort of paradox of, on the one side... there's a kind of purity to that in terms of it's about, you know, success and achievements. But on the other side, it's what that is being harnessed for in terms of the sports washing element that kind of cancels that out. It's a very complex and odd thing.
Yeah, I think on the Second Captain's podcast, James Montagu said he didn't like to use the word sports washing. He preferred the phrase reputation laundering, which I think is probably more accurate. Sports washing sounds a bit, you know, a bit vague, whereas we know that, that's exactly what Man City's owners have done.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the questions that I keep coming back to, and I think it was based on a tweet that I saw somebody else posit, so I can't claim it's an original thought, but it's coming back to talking about, you know, that fan group United with Pride and the gay rights issue. I just keep thinking, like, if I was a gay Newcastle fan, how would I feel about this? And how...
Well, that's why I couldn't understand their statement. I could not understand their statement.
Well, they will probably argue, as I've seen other groups argue, that... it's kind of in the spirit of collaboration, and by being on side, we can affect change. But I think that what the likely outcome is that from a sort of West-facing perspective, we will see change and tolerance, but it won't change anything for, I don't know, gay people living in Saudi. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It'll be a kind of... along the lines of that reputation laundering, I'm sure they will play ball with our cultural values here.
Newcastle rainbow laces all the way, but the owners, you know, are in charge
probably
of a regime
being
where...
locked up.
Yeah.
It's... Which, you know... obviously, I bring my own sensibilities and my own views to it, but, yeah, I just can't... It isn't. I find it really difficult to kind of get my head around that, I have to say.
What do you think it might mean... in the short/medium term for Arsenal? Does it mean anything for Arsenal? I wonder, obviously, you know, in time it's going to be another competitor, another big club in the Premier League. You're like, you know, we had the big two when it was Arsenal and Manchester United, and then it became a, you know, top four, and then the big six, and, you know, we might have a Super Seven or a fucking whatever eight. You know, eventually... we're going to see perhaps a level of investment and ownership wealth in the Premier League where some might argue that it creates actual competitiveness between these super, super, super rich clubs. Like, you know, it's when you look at what's happening in Spain with Real Madrid and Barcelona, and the troubles that they're facing and the loss of the big stars. You know, Messi's not at Barcelona, Ronaldo's not at Real Madrid. You know, they have this history to them, but not perhaps the star quality that they used to. You know, more and more the Premier League is becoming the sort of the home or the destination for the richest owners, and ultimately that's going to mean the best players.
But I think with the dissolution of the Super League, I think the Premier League, I think I said this at the time, the Premier League can be the Super League, in my opinion. In terms of its, you know, global appeal and attracting stars and all those things. The problem for Arsenal, of course, is are they part of that elite group? And, you know, there's four Champions League places. There's going to be at least, in the very near future, at least seven teams looking for those. Maybe more, you know, if you think about teams like Everton, who have access to significant resources. There may be others I'm forgetting as well. But, yeah, I think it's inevitable that Newcastle will be a competitor. I'd say within a few years, that's likely. Because Arsenal, it's not like we're at the summit right now. You know, we're catchable. We're vulnerable in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, even if we do well, we could be treading water in mid-table. You know, an optimistic outlook might be that we have begun a project at a time when it might be like the right time to do it, if you know what I mean. Because when Chelsea, when Abramovich came in at Chelsea, nobody was really expecting anybody to do that. Nobody had considered that kind of ownership, and we'd embarked on this stadium project, and all of a sudden the way that you could compete had completely changed. So rather than have a big stadium that you fill with, you know, extra season ticket holders and extra corporate and all that kind of stuff, it now didn't really matter what size your stadium is. I mean, Chelsea could play in a 20,000-seat stadium. It would make no difference to, you know, how competitive they were, because the resources are not coming from what they generate. It's coming from who owns them. This time, I just wonder if maybe, and I realize this is a very glass half full outlook on things, that if the transfer market is going to get another distortion, which I think it will with
inflation,
Newcastle. Yeah, and it, you know, PSG did it when they, you know, when they spent 200 million whatever on Neymar, all of a sudden that becomes like a benchmark figure. So if Neymar is 200 million, well, this guy is not as good as Neymar, but maybe he's half as good. So he's 100 million. It's like all of a sudden Coutinho is worth 150 million. Of course, he never was and never would be. But the transfer market is distorted by the top end, the deals that are done right at the very top. And I think that is going to happen again when Newcastle come in and start throwing money around. Because what are they going to do? They're going to bring in a new coach. They're going to bring in new players. They're going to have to make like a marquee signing or two, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll be able to like incrementally improve their squad by offering higher wages, more chances of success, all that kind of stuff. The same way that Man City did when they first started, and they spent loads of money on, you know, guys who didn't necessarily get them to the top, but because of the stature of the players, like I think Clive mentioned on the Arsecast on Friday, Robinho, you know, like there's no way.
He was the headline one.
Yeah, there was no way like a player of his stature back then would have gone from Real Madrid to Manchester City, other than, you know, they threw so much money at it, it was impossible for him to say no. So that's what they'll do, I think. And I think the Premier League transfer market might get distorted again when Newcastle come in and start throwing money around. So from our perspective, to have built at least the bones of a new squad, young players, young English players, who I think will get more and more inflated now because of what Newcastle will do. Maybe the timing was okay, assuming we can make this squad work.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's the case. I mean, I suppose you could also make the point that it's a case of kind of the game changing on Arsenal just as they settle on a strategy.
Yeah, you know,
2006, they went with the stadium, they went with the long-term view, and then, of course, you know, the oil money turned up and changed everything. And then here, they've finally settled on a long-term strategy again. And then here come Newcastle with sort of unlimited spending power. I hope you're right, to be honest, and I hope that Arsenal have done this at the right time and it pays dividends. But it does make me think... It does make me wonder if we may have to, if we are to enjoy being Arsenal fans, I do wonder if we may have to slightly sort of recalibrate our criteria for success. I know a lot of people will resist that idea, but I just think when you're competing with nation states, in some cases, with seemingly infinite resources, I mean, in real terms, infinite, you know, compared to other clubs, I think you have to accept that your chances of the kind of success you crave are substantially diminished. And so it's like, well, if that is the case, where do you derive satisfaction? Where do you derive enjoyment? And everyone's answer to that will be different. But like for me, I really like, for example, the strategy that the club are implementing. And I think that, you know, I'm really excited to see the development of this young players. And I love the new sort of found connection that seems to exist between the players and the fans. That seems to be something that's fostering. And I wonder if, like, over the next 5 to 10 years, it may be those elements that keep my interest more than if we're going to win a Premier League anytime soon.
Isn't it weird, though, that, like, Arsenal spending £150 million on young players kind of feels, in the context of what we've just been discussing, vaguely pure in terms of, of like, how football is perceived?
Spend the most. In transfer fees.
Exactly. We spent more than anyone. We spent some fucking money. And at the same time, we're looking at Newcastle and thinking, well, they're going to spend a load of money. You know, not that we're looking down our noses at that, because that's just inevitable. Every club does it. They're just going to do it on a on an industrial scale, I think. But in terms of trying to build something or organically, if that's the right word, you know, it is a weird thing to consider, given, you know, what we've done is just spend either a billionaire's money or a billionaire has helped finance the club to have that kind of liquid cash to spend.
True, true. But I think it is worth saying that in one sense, they kind of give with one hand, take away with the other, in that as much as we've spent that outlay on the transfer fees, I think there is a kind of restructuring and redistribution of salary going on that will, I would imagine, put the club in a sort of slightly, what's the word, healthier position, you know, it's, with their wage bill. And I think that probably plays into this idea of, like, this is sort of relatively sensibly spent. I mean, that can be disputed in individual cases, but it is odd. It is odd. Like, we, you could argue Arsenal were the big spenders in the last summer transfer window, and yet it feels like we're about to be absolutely blown out of the water.
There's a question here on Twitter from Fred, who's at RLF86. He said, I'm sure you're going to talk about it, but what are some of the long-term implications of the Newcastle takeover? Will the owners of Villa, Everton or ours up their spending to compete, accept mid-table mediocrity, or walk away? What is it going to mean? I mean, is this like a sort of footballing arms race in a way? Whereby, you know, another rich owner, another oligarch, another nation state will come in to, you know, pick off a, I don't want to call Newcastle a small club, you know what I mean? But what I mean is they haven't had any tangible success since the 1950s. They haven't won a trophy since the 1950s. Huge support, huge fan base, big, big stadium, all of that kind of stuff. So the framework is there, but an underperforming club, I think, is probably what I should have said. You know, does that make these clubs more attractive? You know, is it possible that, you know, clubs like Arsenal, maybe even Liverpool, to an extent, could become like second rate? Is that, that's the wrong way of saying it, but pushed out of this conversation that exists, you know, when it comes to being truly competitive?
Yes, I think that is possible. I think that the hierarchy will inevitably shift. And we're kind of already seeing that. You know, we've all seen what happened when Chelsea came in and Manchester City came in. And what happens in the short term is as much as we might be uncomfortable with it, in the short to mid-term, this will sort of inject a life and excitement into the Premier League product, if I can use that horrible word. You know, this will be a narrative that plays out on Sky Telly over the next 5 to 10 years of Newcastle's resurgence, you know, probably crowned by them winning the Premier League or the Champions League or whatever it might be. And it will be framed as there's another competitor in the mix. This is the strongest league we've ever had. You know, it's not just a big six, it's a big eight or something now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we'll only see the dangers of the kind of dominance they may be able to exert in the longer term. You know, if you look now, the consistency with which Manchester City and Chelsea are right up there is beginning to be a little concerning, alarming, and that's sort of quite a few years into those developments. So I don't think we'll see any of the current owners trying to get out on this basis. I think that, as I say, the Premier League as a sort of telly product will benefit from this in the short term, and that will see people desperate to hold on to their stake within it. And in fact, what they'll be doing, and I suspect what some of these crisis meetings are about, will be trying to ensure that they don't get squeezed out of the revenue that comes into the league by these, by the likes of Newcastle. You know, they'll be saying, we bring X million fans to the table. We bring this many eyes from China or America or where else it might be. How can that be reflected in the money we take if we're not in the top four, say?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is that conversation that's been going on for a long time about, you know, the biggest clubs wanting a bigger portion of the, you know, the revenue from foreign rights and all of that kind of stuff. And I think at least the one thing you would say about the way the Premier League money is divvied out in that sense is that it's equal to all the clubs. Whereas I know that, you know, big clubs like Arsenal, like Manchester United, like Liverpool have been lobbying hard in the past for a bigger slice of that pie, perhaps because they thought stuff like this was going to come along.
Yeah, and I think that lobbying will only increase now. But I don't anticipate, like, say, to reflect on our own situation, someone like Stan cashing out or selling up at this point. Because I think, I just think that the, from his perspective, the league is going to attract probably even more attention, become, as I said earlier, become a kind of super league of its own. And any owner of sports franchises is going to want a stake in that.
It's a mad one, isn't it? It is a mad
one. It is really mad. And it definitely, I mean, I can't lie, you know, amidst all the ethical concerns and my worry about the game, you know, I did just have this sort of feeling in the pit of my stomach as an Arsenal fan of like, well,
we're fucked.
From a competitive perspective, yeah. Like we could really easily get kind of squeezed out here. And then it sort of becomes about, as I said before, like what does, you have to, I mean, listen, there are fans who support teams up and down the country who've never won a thing in their lives, you know, and for whom that is their bread and butter. But it's such a shift for us, having been at the top, having been at the summit at the sort of turn of the millennium, two decades on, to be looking at the situation thinking like, well, we might get, you know, we might have our Leicester year where we win the league, or we might win a few cups, or might sneak into the top four. But in terms of dominating English football, I do think that's probably gone right now.
Yeah, I mean, dominating is such a big word, you know, but being competitive and having a chance at least to sort of mix it with, you know, what you consider the traditional big boys, as Liverpool, United, Chelsea in recent years, Man City, of course, you know, but it all feels increasingly artificial, I have to say. And that's maybe, again, something we're all going to have to reckon with to some extent or another. And, you know, what do you get from it? Do you get enjoyment from it still? Do you not? Is there, you know, there would be something very exhilarating and exciting and rewarding, I think, if, you know, if we could be a competitive team doing it the way we're doing it. And again, I realize that is by spending a lot of money, but also with a clear footballing strategy. It's not like we're going out to buy Galacticos to you know, mix it with the big boys. So if you can, if you could grow something, you know, albeit you've spent big on the ingredients, if you could grow something that becomes really competitive, I think that would be, that would be very enjoyable. You know, at least to be, what's the word? You know, competing with and up there with these guys who have those resources, who are bolstered by endless, endless billions in their bank accounts, to mix it with those guys doing it the way we were doing it would be great fun, I think.
Yeah, I don't think. Get me wrong. It can happen, and sometimes it will happen. It will probably depend on us getting an awful lot right.
Yeah.
You know, almost nearly everything right. But I think inevitably that will, that will happen. I mean, the other sort of thing, it will happen from time to time. I mean, what my worry is that over time the trend will be so much in favour of these infinitely wealthy clubs. But I'm sure there will be seasons and occasions and spells where we do threaten that and we do find ourselves in the mix, and that will be thrilling, because I suppose what you can cling to if you're not winning things as an Arsenal fan is, you know, do I believe in the way we are doing things? You know, am I excited about the players, the style, the project? Basically, I think being a football fan is tolerable if you believe that things might be better tomorrow. And what Arsenal are doing right now enables that belief.
Mm.
And I think that's of critical importance.
Mm. It's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays out. Anyway, look, there's going to be plenty more to come on all this, I'm sure. So the other thing
is just in the very short term, I mean, you know, Newcastle, they're not going to turn this round in one January transfer window.
No.
So it will take a little bit of time, and there may be some teething problems as they inevitably figure that out and, you know, buy the wrong player for too much money. And so maybe it's also imperative that Arsenal try to capitalise on their kind of head start while they can.
Agreed, yeah.
So, you know, it brings, although we've got a kind of long, mid to long term project here, it brings the short term into very immediate focus too.
Mm, okay, well, look, short term is coming up after the interlull, but I think we can save discussion of much of that until maybe Friday on the Arsecast then. But now we'll take a break, will we, and do some more questions in part two.
Yeah, and we've even got questions that aren't about Newcastle.
Wow. Somewhere. Okay.
Yeah. Exciting times.
We'll be right back. Welcome.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you're an Arsblog member on Patreon. You can sign up if you like, patreon.com/Arsblog. James, you said you've got questions that aren't about Newcastle. So how about you kick off with a question that isn't about Newcastle?
Okay. Yeah, why not? So... what about this one from the Discord and Blade? I don't know if it's the vampire. And Blade says, after watching Phil Foden for England the other night sit a bit deeper in midfield and ping balls all over the pitch, do you think this is something Odegaard could replicate? I thought it was super effective.
I mean, he has the passing range.
He kind of did it against Burnley, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to say exactly because it wasn't necessarily a brilliant performance from Arsenal on the day. No. We won, but he was obviously put there to kind of do that. I'd have to go back and look at his passing stats against Burnley to see how effective he was in there or wasn't. I mean, I think he's certainly capable of it, and we've talked a bit about the absence of Granit Xhaka and... you know, how that might impact the, you know, the formation and the way that Mikel Arteta sets up his teams. So I think he's a little bit different to Phil Foden, but definitely in terms of his technique and his passing range, he could do that. He could definitely do that. He's a hard worker as well. I'm just going back to look at the player statistics.
Same. I'm just having a look. So he was Arsenal's best passer on the day, 52 of 62. 84% basically pass completion, 33 of those in the opposition half. So basically half in the opposition half, half in his own. And his, I'm just looking at his sort of pass selection, his most frequent pass actually was Gabriel, which tells you quite how deep he was playing.
Receiving or giving or playing to?
Playing to Gabriel.
Wow.
Yeah. 10 times. But I guess because he was often receiving, that he came deep to receive the ball, maybe back to the opposition, you know, to the fullback. He also played 9 passes to Bukayo Saka. So it wasn't like it was, you know, it was sort of heavily weighted towards Gabriel. But interesting nonetheless. I think he can do that, actually. I think he... I thought the way he played against Burnley was really interesting. I mean, there's sort of been a bit of debate about, was it a 4-3-3-3 or 4-3-3-3? That would be the formation. If we can get that on the pitch, that would really help. or a 4-1-4-1. I felt at times it was almost, you know, diamond-shaped with Odegaard and Smith-Rowe either side of Partey or him and Partey on a slight slant. I think it's a possibility. I think Sambi Lokonga, you know, was picked for the Brighton game in that role, but I'll be interested to see what he does for Palace on Monday. You know, a home game, opposition I think we really should feel confident enough to kind of do what we want tactically. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Arteta sticks with Sambi or if he mixes it up a bit in the middle of the park.
Yeah, I mean, we have to wait and see how everyone comes back after the interlull as well.
I've forgotten
so
about
there
that.
There is that side of things. So, yeah. But like you, yeah, I would like to see us, if that can be considered, going for it, because you get that extra attacking player on the pitch if you drop Odegaard deep and you put in Smith Rowe, Pepe, etc., etc. The conundrum then is sort of like, which side do you put Saka on and which side do you put Pepe on? So that is one. I mean, here's a question from Andy Bick, who says, it's become apparent so far that Martinelli and Pepe are going to have bit parts again this season. How can Mikel Arteta expect them to be effective if they're sitting on the sidelines? Cup games are few and far between, and I can already see the loan move noise before January comes along. I think we talk about this last week with Martinelli? You know, whether a January loan would be a good idea, but given Aubameyang and Pepe are going to be off at the AFCON, there's no way we can loan him out. But it is about how much involvement he's going to get over the coming weeks and months, because he does need to play a bit.
Yeah, I think we talked about that on we did an episode of statements.
That's what it was. Yeah.
For the Patreon listeners, and there was a debate on that about Martinelli and his immediate future. I think we both said we thought he couldn't go in January just because of losing Aubameyang and Pepe to AFCON. And the more I look at the AFCON, the more it worries me. I have to be honest, it's not just those two. It's also Thomas Partey. It's also Mohamed Elneny. People will mourn that one slightly less. But it's a decent chunk of the squad, isn't it?
It is.
Heading away for at least a few weeks. So that is a little alarming. I guess we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But I mean, Pepe, he did start the first few games, it is worth remembering, and he's kind of the 12th man in the team, I would say. Like, he's the first off the bench, and he's sort of the first, I would say, to come in if we change the shape or lost one of those attacking players. I think he's going to get plenty of minutes. I think the Martinelli case is a little bit different. You know, he has been an unused sub, I think, 5 times. This season. And I think maybe he more than anyone has been a victim of the change back to 3-8-3 changes in a game. You know, it's sort of like it's genuinely quite difficult for him to get on the field at present.
Do you think there's like some clarity about what exactly his role is or his position is? Do you think that could be an issue? Because like if you take the setup where we use Emil Smith Rowe on the left hand side, and that's
very
quite effective. Yeah, exactly. A completely different kind of player to Smith Rowe. He doesn't do and can't do what Smith Rowe does there. And if that's what Arteta wants from a player in that position, it's not going to be Martinelli. Is he a centre forward? It seems like Lacazette is, you know, he's the one that came on for Aubameyang against Brighton. It wasn't Martinelli. So
I think it's as simple
as
that.
He's a little
really,
bit stuck,
you know?
Isn't he?
Yeah, like if you're going to bring on a new centre-forward, it's going to be, well, for Arteta, it's going to be Lacazette. And if you're going to bring on a wide attacker, at the moment it's Pepe. And Martinelli's sort of the odd one out. And, you know, often they've been making changes in central midfield, bringing on Maitland-Niles or Lokonga. That's your three subs. And let's not forget, there have been games where Lacazette's not got on the pitch either.
Yeah,
I know people are a bit more at ease with that because he's not part of the long-term future. Whereas we're all hoping that Martinelli will be. But yeah, he's in a bit of an awkward spot. I'm not... I sort of foresaw this, to be honest. I always thought that it would be tricky for him to get a regular place. And I do think the way Smith Rowe plays from the left-hand side is a big part of that. It's such a big change to go with Martinelli there that I don't necessarily foresee that happening too often. But I'm not, I mean, I'm also not stressed. I do think, you know, it may just be one where he has to show a bit of patience. And I know that we all want to see more of him and we're all excited about what he can do. But he is still young. It is worth remembering that as well. What about you? Are you worried about it?
Yeah, a little bit. Just because he's not playing as much as we would like. And, you know, last season he had an injury hit season, I think, because, you know, he came back after that knee injury and was eased back in and then got an ankle injury. And, you know, he's still really young, but I think clarity over where he's going to play would give us more room for discussion about this, because right now we're not 100% sure about exactly where it is he's going to play. He did start, didn't he start the Chelsea game up front?
He did. He started the Brentford game as well.
Yeah, but Balogun was playing up front in that game.
Yeah.
So,
left.
You know, it's really about where Martinelli is going to play. So, like, I could see all the arguments for like how a loan might be beneficial, but yeah, I don't know. It's a strange one.
The issue is, I think, in January you've got the AFCON situation, which will, I think, prohibit a loan move. And at the and so you could say, well, maybe we should have loaned him out for the first half of the season. But you've got to remember, at the start of the season, we had no Aubameyang and no Lacazette. So they
and
had
no
to keep
Nketiah
him around.
Either.
And no Nketiah either. So they had to keep him around at that time. So a loan move sort of, you know, it's not been possible for a variety of different reasons. I think his time will come. I think it will continue to get minutes in domestic cups. I mean, it's Leeds, isn't it, in not too distant future. I think it's a fortnight tomorrow. I think he'll play that game. It's just one of those tough ones, you know. If we had the Europa League, he'd be playing every week.
Yeah.
Okay, enough of that. Here's a question that relates to Newcastle. Chris BK says, is there any concern that the new Newcastle regime may try to poach some of our best young players, as Man City did with Nasri, Clichy and Adebayo?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. You know, why wouldn't they go after some of the best players in the league? And when you're... like, you can become vulnerable pretty quickly with a player's situation. You know what I mean? Am I right in thinking that come the summer, Bukayo Saka will have 2 years left on his deal? I know he signed a new contract.
It was 2020.
Yeah.
She signed.
Well, I seem to think it was a 4-year deal. I could be wrong, but.
So, I can't remember what report at the time. Yeah, Transfermarkt report that as 2024.
Now, whether there might be an option.
An option or, yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think
it would be a renegotiation point. And I think also you're talking about a player who has gone from being a promising young player to a regular England international in that time.
Yeah.
His agent will probably expect that to be reflected.
Of course. Look, as we always say, the best way to keep your best young players is to ensure they have an environment in which they can thrive. They enjoy their football. The chances of winning things are there. I mean, when it boils right down to it, that is why a lot of our players left. It's why Cesc left. It's why Van Persie left. I'm not going to make any excuses for Nasri. But, you know, there was a sense that Arsenal were not going to be as competitive as some of the other teams in the Premier League. And that was when, you know, there was still only a big four, top four. You know, we finished top four year after year after year with those teams. But it wasn't about, you know, being in the Champions League. It was about being in a team that could win things. And now, obviously, the landscape has shifted quite significantly. Whereas we, I think, you know, would look at a top four finish this season as a real success. Back then, we were thinking, well, that's not good enough. And that wasn't good enough for some of the players. So it's all about a trajectory, I guess, that the team is on. If we're a good team, then Arsenal boys like Smith Rowe, like Saka, should want to stay. But if the team is underperforming and somebody comes in with big money transfer fee, big money in salary, and an almost ironclad guarantee that you're going to be playing for a club that could compete for the Premier League and will be in the Champions League, etc., etc., you're pretty much screwed. You know? That's the simple reality of football.
I mean, it's interesting in the question the players mentioned, Nasri, Clichy and Adebayo. I mean, by the time at least two of those went, I'm thinking of Clichy and Adebayo, it wasn't mourned too much by Arsenal fans. In the short term, do you think the presence of Newcastle United may make for a kind of willing buyer for some of the players we might not want to keep?
There was a question, I think, about this. Anita Holder who's at Anita Holder on Twitter, said, which current Arsenal player would you be willing to sell to Newcastle at a ridiculously inflated price? You know, because City did, I mean, they bought Clichy, they bought Nasri, they bought Kolo Touré,
yeah.
Was there one more? I can't remember.
Adebayor, sure.
Yeah. So, they gave us a lot of money.
On a free, unfortunately, but yeah, they did give us plenty of money down the years. Some of it was well spent for them, some of it less so.
Mm.
Is there an Arsenal player? Which one would I be looking to sell? I mean,
Kolasinac.
Well, I do wonder if, like, a lot of these players who are at Arsenal have played Champions League football previously. And it depends how smartly run Newcastle are going to be, you know, and what exactly their sort of recruitment profile they're looking for is. You know, they gave us a decent chunk of money for Joe Willock in the summer.
Yeah.
They're going to have a hell of a lot more than that to spend now. I don't know. I think in a lot of cases it comes a bit late, you know. Like, if this had happened with Saudi Arabia, say, in the summer, then someone like Lacazette, for example, you think, okay, would they be interested in a, you know, guy's played in the Champions League for Lyon and played for Arsenal. But I think with 6 months left on his contract, you're not really going to get the uptake there that you might otherwise. Also, I worry about, you know, while it might be good in the short term, you know, you get a few quid off them in exchange for some players that help them on their way up. It's only in the short term, right? In the long term, they're still going to probably blast past us. But listen, I mean, if they want to give us, you know, 30 million for Rob Holding or something like that, let's talk.
Yeah. I've got a Bernd Leno you could have here as well.
I've got a Bernd Leno.
Callum Chambers is lovely.
Yeah.
He's a lovely guy. He'll really connect with the Newcastle fans.
I guess a Hector Bellerin, you know, when he comes back from his loan. There's probably a few more that, you know, like you could talk yourself into.
For sure.
Imagine Pablo Marie in the resplendent black and white. They'd love it.
I can imagine that, yeah.
They just need to be convinced. Do you have any... I tweeted the other day that I've got this sneaky feeling that Newcastle will go for Harry Kane as their kind of...
I saw your tweet, all right. Your tweet. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they tried, but it would really surprise me if he went for it.
Right.
Because
I just think he seems like a man who sort of looks a bit broken at Spurs, and like his escape route has been blocked off, really, in the case of Manchester City. And I wonder if they might be able to frame it to him as, you know, you'll come here, you'll wear Alan Shearer's number 9, you'll lead the team into this revolution, and your parting gift will be Champions League qualification. I don't know. I guess it depends if he thinks he's ever going to get the move where he gets immediate access to trophies.
Well, that's it. It did seem like his desire to leave was because he wanted to actually win something, which, of course, he has no chance of doing,
given that he plays for Tottenham.
Because I don't know if you heard this or not, but news emerged last week that they get battered everywhere they go.
And it's everywhere they go.
Everywhere they go. We know he's not going to win anything at Spurs. I would just be really surprised. But then again,
what do you think Newcastle will look to do? Like, do you think...
Will they be smart? I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I mean, they could be, but I think they've got enough money to make mistakes. You know, that's the thing. They've got enough money where they can just keep throwing more and more money at it until they get it right.
I think they'll be... like maybe a marquee or a couple of marquee names, and then it will be sort of like big six cast-offs. Like Jesse Lingard feels like nailed on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I know.
Players
what you
who aren't quite there for the biggest teams.
Kovacic, you know, or somebody like
sure,
that.
Sure, Callum Hudson-Odoi. Something like that, you know.
What do you think their first big signing will be? Because I'm pretty sure... it'll have to be an attacker of some kind, because there is nothing like that kind of signing to really excite people and to sort of, you know, in inverted commas, make a statement of intent, you know? So it'll be a big name striker from somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, like I say, I have a slight sneaky feeling about Kane, but I think that'd be more one for the summer. It really depends which route they go. Will they just look to get someone who's like immediate established quality? Will they look to sign a young player? Will they be doing a sort of a similar thing to Arsenal in the market in terms of looking at a 5-year project?
5-year project when you've got $350 billion to spend, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Money and we could do it in like 6 weeks. Easy.
I guess the real answer to this is it's about the really interesting moves are going to be who they get in to really run the club. You know, Steve Bruce. It's not really an appropriate analogy to use, but his head is very much on the chopping block right now, and I think the manager is going to be fascinating. And I think the people above the manager as well.
Well, yeah, that's going to be very interesting, because who are they going to bring in to properly run? Because you assume they're going to be run like a Chelsea, like a Man City, where the coach, as good as he might be, is instantly and always expendable. If you know what I mean. So at Chelsea,
yeah,
they have
more
these.
True of Chelsea than Man City. Because Man City, I think, was about. It felt to me, anyway, like it was about creating an infrastructure for Pep.
In
some ways, it was laying the ground for him. And, you know, maybe Newcastle are like, we want it to be Klopp in 3 years. And so we bring in the sporting director dude who's leaving Liverpool, and we create that infrastructure so that when he's done with Liverpool, you know, maybe we can get him. I don't know. It'll be fascinating to see. So interesting. It's a great job for somebody.
Well, look, anyone who goes there is going to leave much richer than when they came in.
I imagine the pay will be all right.
Yeah.
Yes, very interesting. By the way, actually, I thought I'd ask this because you mentioned Bern Leno there, and there was a question here on the Discord, but who was it by?
I think it was by Bellerin Than Out.
Was it?
I think
what does it say? It may be the one.
Is it? Yes, it is.
Yes, and the question was, once Leno goes in the summer, so I think that's a fair assumption.
Mm-hmm.
What profile of player do you envisage being Ramsdale's backup? Will we go for a young up-and-coming Ramsdale-esque keeper, or should we go for a been-there-and-done-it type? And who would be your first, second choice?
That's a really good question. I suspect it would make more sense to have that kind of... If Ramsdale has firmly established himself as the number one, and given he's, 23 years of age, and will have plenty of years left ahead of him, I think you do probably go for that more experienced goalkeeper, the classic number two type, your Adrian, your whatever, you know, I can't even remember the names, but everyone knows the kind of profile of player I'm talking about, where there's...
Stuart Taylor.
Yeah, exactly.
Richard Wright.
Yeah, exactly. Those guys. Probably a loose end still. Stuart Taylor. Still at it, I'm sure. Because I mean,
his football age is very young. You know what I mean? Like
six.
Thomas Rosicki.
He's six. Yeah. I think it would probably be that. I don't know who, but that would make more sense to me if Ramsdale has firmly established himself as the number one. What do you think?
Yeah, and that's the big if, isn't it? Like, you know, we don't know how the season's going to play out. Hopefully, he continues as he started. And if that is the case, I think bringing in someone more experienced makes loads of sense.
Mm.
I also think, like, it's good for the young goalkeepers in the squad to have someone experienced to learn off and work with. It's not just Ramsdale, it's people like Okonkwo, Carl Hein. I think it'd be great for them to be around someone who sort of been there and done it to an extent.
I did see a question, and I can't find it now, apologies, but it was about Bernd Leno or Aaron Ramsdale's gloves. Do you find them slightly creepy? bit disturbing.
I think they're Adidas, are they?
I don't know.
And they're sort of like a Predator glove, you know? Like, they're kind of... They've got, like, grippy bits all over them.
Mm.
But they are slightly alarming. They sort of have the look... You know when people wear those socks that have toes?
Oh, yeah, you see people... Don't people do long-distance running in those kind of things?
Yeah, yeah, they do. I saw someone run past me in them the other day, actually.
Ugh.
Yeah, I know.
They're gross.
I spat at them for good measure. But I, yeah, it's, they are slightly odd. They're sort of... and they're sort of tight to his hand, you know what I mean? It's like they're almost reptilian.
Mm, reptilian, that's exactly it. They're a bit like... what was that film about the woman who she falls in love with a kind of lizard man who lives in a cage? It was out a couple of years ago. It might have been Oscar nominated.
It sounds brilliant. I've got no idea what it is. Do you mean The Man Who Lives in the Water?
Yeah, the man, The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
The Shape of Water.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's just his first step into transitioning into a being who can live in the water.
Well, do you know that his nickname is the Lizard, Aaron Ramsdale?
Why is that?
Well, he was asked about this the other day I think it was a video with him away on England duty, and that they were asking about nicknames, and he was like, obviously Rambo, Rammers,
Rammy,
but also
Rammy
all the
Ramerson.
Sheffield United boys, Rammy, Ram Ram.
Yeah.
But he said, all the Sheffield United boys call me the Lizard. And he was asked why, and he said, oh, it's because I've always got my tongue out in photographs. But I don't know. Is it because they know that those gloves are, in fact, not gloves, but just the start of his skin, transforming into some sort of agile goalkeeping reptile?
Do we do, you know, when a player gets a physical and they go through their medical, et cetera, do we check for tails? Maybe he's got
a
tail.
Yeah. Do they do some sort of DNA test to be like, is this man a mammal? Are we sure? He looks like a goalkeeper. Are we sure he's a mammal?
Do you remember the TV series V?
No.
Remember that? You don't?
That?
It was probably the 80s, so you weren't born.
I was
like that.
Born, but only just. First episode, 84. I missed the start of it.
Right, yeah. But basically, it was about aliens appearing all over the world in spaceships, and they came down and they pretended to be like our friends and we'll help you, etc., etc. But then it turned out they were actually lizard people underneath it all. They were like space alien lizards and shit like that. So,
hang on a minute. Isn't David Icke the sort of famous conspiracy theorist?
Yeah.
Who believes the royal family are lizards. Was he not himself?
He was a goalkeeper.
So Ramsdale is kind of the prophesied nemesis to David Icke, the lizard goalkeeper that Icke has always lived in fear of. Yeah. There's a whole subplot to this.
Oh, God. Okay. Speaking of goalkeepers,
I know I haven't let you ask a question for ages.
That's okay.
But I saw a good question here that was related to goalkeepers. Maybe you were going to say the same. You said string of goalkeepers. It's DJ Rad B.
I thought
it was interesting. Different one. They said, are we okay with a Runnison every now and again if we get a Ramsdale or a Raya? We didn't get Raya, but we tried our hardest and he looks great. I.e. a low-profile mistake that doesn't financially hamstring the club while we build a series of smaller bets rather than £50 million or £72 million risks?
I genuinely don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah.
Because I just think it
don't
was...
Don't nick my catchphrase, mate.
I think it was just a circumstance, wasn't it? Given everything that had happened with Emi Martinez. Mm. And, like, I still don't think it was... I don't think I'm okay with it because it was just a bad signing. He wasn't good enough. You know, I don't think you can really excuse those kind of signings, even if, you know, it was temporary, even if it wasn't exactly what we wanted to do. It still reflects on your work, you know?
Yeah, I see the point of, like, if you can't get your main target, is it better to...
Mm.
Do something that's just expedient and inexpensive. But I would sort of argue No. Like, if you... Like, if Arsenal weren't going to get Raya last season, then Ramsdale moved last summer for 18 million, less than we've paid this summer.
Yeah.
Like, so I kind of feel like if you can't get your number one target, go for number two. Don't go for number 300 just because it's cheap.
And because the goalkeeping coach knows him well, yeah.
Yeah, kind of. Like, I think ultimately what happens in those situations is you get stuck with a player you can't really move. I also think that, like, if Runarsson ends up back in the squad as, like, third-choice goalkeeper or something, it's not a disaster. But that's because that player never plays. Like, you can maybe apply what this question suggests to goalkeepers, to backup goalkeepers. But I'd say any outfield position, no, definitely don't do that. Because they'll have to play.
Yeah, exactly. You know, goalkeeper is quite specific, and we were desperate, but I still think we could have done better. Here's one also about goalkeepers from Aaron Power, who's at Aaron Power 17. He said, what do you think about Thibaut Courtois' interview bringing up player welfare and money? I'm sure you guys agree with it, but do you think we may hit a point where if there is a mass protest from players, any type of difference could be made? And just to put this in context, he was talking about, I think, having to play a third, fourth choice playoff final, third, fourth playoff for the Nations League. Like, very few people gave a fish's tit about the final itself. Nobody cared about third or fourth. And his point was that this is just another game on the telly. They can sell the rights for it. It's a money-based decision. And he's talking about, you know, World Cup next November. When are players going to get a rest? We're all going to get injured, he said. We're going to get injured, and that's going to be that.
Mm-hmm. It was a quite amazing interview, actually. It's very rare to hear a footballer talk like that against the governing bodies. I suppose it's complicated by the fact that as the demands on footballers increase, in general, so does the pay packet. And how can I put it? To a certain extent, they know what they're getting into, you know? Like, they're very well rewarded, and it's not ideal, but they are very well paid. So I think I don't know how much public sympathy they would gain in such a movement, but it's why this whole conversation around the World Cup and the international breaks is interesting, because as much as there is a financial incentive for those discussions, I do think sooner or later people have to look at player welfare if they want to preserve the quality of the game. I mean, we saw, I think, in the pandemic and the crazy schedule that produced, the impact that can have on performance and the quality of the actual games we see. It does feel like if we just keep bleeding these footballers dry, eventually, and I hate to use that word again, the product will suffer.
Yeah, I mean, I think when a player like Courtois, a high profile player, and let's acknowledge that he's a goalkeeper as well, it's not that they have an easy ride, but, you know, the physical demands on a goalkeeper are not quite the same as a player who's running 10, 11, 12 kilometres every game. But I think when a player of his stature starts to speak out about something like this, people should listen. People should listen. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure behind the scenes when, you know, we either think of footballers as injured or fit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's not that binary.
And it's really not that binary. You know, there are levels of fitness and levels of injury, and players are playing through pain with aches and strains and niggles and injections and all of those kinds of things to get them through games. And, you know, I think in some cases it has brought about serious injury for certain players because they've been pushed too far, too soon, whatever it might be. But when someone like Courtois speaks up about this, you know, the World Cup every 2 years, a European Championship every 2 years, you know, it's you've got to listen to the players and the quality of the football that we get as fans, as TV viewers, as observers from far and wide. You know, if that diminishes, then you know, the game itself becomes less attractive, and then you've less reason to have a World Cup every 2 years, you know? So you've got to find the balance. I do think it is ridiculous now, though. You know, there doesn't appear to be any substantial time off for players to recharge their batteries. Like you say, they get well paid. They're very well rewarded. You know, the kind of money that, you know, a lot of people out there will think, well, who gives a shit if you get a hamstring strain? You still get paid. Who cares about you? You know, but at the end of the day, they want to do their jobs to the best of their abilities. And I think at some point there might be a coming together of players who are saying, no, you know, enough now. We have to have a certain amount of mandated rest every season because, you know, they're going away and playing like three international games in these international breaks sometimes, you know? So it is crazy, but it's a debate that's been going on for a long time. And so far there hasn't been any kind of solution.
And I think you're right. I think it would have to be the players that would have to sort of make a really concerted effort to change that. This was a really important question from Al Wayne, who's at AlWayne75. And Al says, why is it impossible to say Ben White's name without saying Ben?
You know what?
Do you know what he means there?
I know exactly what he means. It just, White.
He's a first name plus surname guy.
Yeah. First name. Yeah, he is. Because even when I'm writing the blog sometimes, you know, it seems wrong just writing White, because normally White. What I would do, my convention would be to use somebody's full name first. So if I'm talking about, you know, the first time I mention Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, I will say Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, but afterwards just use his surname, as is the custom, like Theo Walcott, and then it becomes Walcott, whatever it might be. But it doesn't seem quite right with Ben White. I don't know what it is. It's the one syllable name?
I think it might just be that, the shortness of the syllables.
Like if he was called Benjamin White, would
we'd be dropping that Benjamin.
We would, wouldn't we? He'd just be White.
Ben White. I wonder if that will wear off over time. Do you know what I mean? Like, will we start calling him White? Whitey. White. You know?
Yeah. I don't know.
White. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else in the Arsenal squad that applies to quite the same extent. I don't think it does.
No.
I don't think it does. I mean, obviously, there are players who are determined to be known by just their first name, like Thomas or...
Gabriel,
Cedric. But Ben White. Maybe it'll always just be Ben White. Maybe he should have Ben White on the back of his shirt, to be honest. Bit of extra revenue for the club.
Yeah, a few extra letters in each one.
Yeah. But yeah, it's odd. Now I'm going to think about that every time we say Ben White for the remainder of us doing this podcast.
We'll just keep calling him Ben White. Or do we try and bring about the change by just calling him White?
It feels horrible, though. It feels wrong.
And calling him Ben just feels too familiar. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't call him. Who am I to call him Ben? So
we don't know him. Yeah. Ben did well there. No. White did well there. No. Ben White did well. Yeah, that sounds right.
That's it. Ben White.
Ben forever.
Ben White forever. Okay, here is a question from... Where is it gone now? JD, who's at JDesai25. He said, with Jack training with us, rumours with regards Ox... and Ramsey not playing much for Juve. If you were forced to get one of them back to Arsenal, who would you choose and why? I mean, the Ox thing has got to be the most ludicrous thing I've heard in a long time.
Do it all. Get the band back together, I say. Bring Tomáš Rosický out of retirement. You know. Well, first of all, I'm really glad that the club have reached out to Jack and, you know, given him this opportunity, somewhere to train, somewhere to study his coaching badges. I think that's really nice. And I think it's shows loyalty to a player who came through the academy and was a fantastic servant. But I think also fans are going to love that, aren't they? And, you know, it's a heartwarming thing to see him back there. I also was really pleased to see David Seaman, albeit informally involved with the academy, you know. I do feel like there was a kind of odd period where, towards the end of Arsene Wenger's reign, maybe, or just before the end, it was sort of quite, it felt like it was quite, he was very discerning about who he would and wouldn't let back into the club in some ways. And that's really not the case now. You know, we're full of ex-players in all sorts of roles. And even people like Jack and see, look, just Jack. You can just say Jack with him. Mm. And David Seaman coming back, it's great to see. I don't foresee either Aaron Ramsey or Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain returning to the club, though, I must say. Mm. Do you?
No. No, I mean,
what's going on with Oxlade-Chamberlain? I don't really know. So he's now 28. What's his standing at Liverpool right now? I'm not really sure.
I don't know. Is he playing? Mm. Is he injured?
Let's have a look. He's played one, started one Premier League game, came on in another, started a League Cup game, a couple of substitute appearances in the Champions League.
Right.
So he's on the fringes of this team, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know why we would bring him back. Where does he play? Does anyone know?
Central midfield.
Does he, though? Is he, though? Is it?
According to this Who Scored data, he does.
Right. No, I mean, that ship has well and truly sailed. I don't think Jack is you know, the fact that he hasn't got any kind of club probably tells you a bit about his ability to play at the Arsenal level. Ramsey, look, he's playing for Juventus, not really playing a great deal, but, you know, of the three, he's about the only one that you could find a place in the team for sure.
Yeah, and I don't see, you know, somebody else asked about, you know, might Jack become a transfer in January with the African Cup of Nations. I don't see it. But I can never, ever rule it entirely out because of the extraordinary Sol Campbell signing that happened, you know, a few years ago when he came back to train and ended up, you know, playing, scoring in the Champions League and playing in a North London derby. I mean, that was unbelievable. That was a bit never bad, say never.
Okay, a couple of quick ones to finish us off. Tony Kent, who's at 2-0 down, says, do you think it's possible for Katie McCabe to score normal goals, or are we stuck with seeing her score incredible goals every week?
It's the Thierry Henry problem. You know, we need a fox in the box. I'm sick of these 40-yarders. I mean, she is having her own private goal of the season competition,
yeah,
it seems.
Amazing. Amazing.
I actually think I preferred the one she scored this week to last week. It just was such a... I mean, she scored a sensational goal last week for about 40 yards out on the right touchline. But this one at the weekend, the take and the volley into the far top corner...
It was nonchalant, wasn't it?
It is sumptuous, yeah. Really fantastic goal. And great to see the women's team, you know, bounce back from a very difficult Barcelona game. On the domestic front, they're absolutely flying.
Yeah, brilliant goal. And what a season. Well, not just this season, but what a period of form she is going through in her career. Katie McCabe, incredible. Final one from Highbury underscore lover, who is at non-negotiable CF, like that little nod to Spanish football club naming. He says, which Arsenal player would you pick to be the next James Bond if there was an opportunity?
Great question. I saw one like this last week, actually. I've seen the James Bond film, have you?
No, I'm not really a big Daniel Craig fan.
Right, I think
he reminds me of a potato.
Sure.
And I'm not really a big fan of the new James Bond films.
The name is Potato.
James Potato.
They are weird, the new Bond films, in that they sort of try and straddle quite a sort of earnest, realistic approach to things, but then they'll occasionally throw in the sort of odd one-liner and it feels very out of context. They've lost some of that sense of lightheartedness.
I remember one of his first ones I went to go see in the cinema, and like the baddie was just not... You know, you need a bit of a pantomime villainry to a baddie, a James Bond baddie. And this was like this guy was like, ho, 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 see if you can stop me, Mr. Bond. I'm going to take most of the water in this particular region and keep it in a tank in the desert, and you won't be able to get it. I was thinking, is that what James Bond is saving? Like some water? There's loads of it. You know,
so I
found them a bit like uninspiring, and they don't quite know whether they want to be old James Bond or Jason Bourne films or whatever. So I'm not interested in the new one.
On the subject of that, by the way, I can see Granit Xhaka playing an excellent Bond villain. I think he's got the right.
But he'd get himself sent off about 20 minutes into the film and it'd be useless.
Well, they always lose, the Bond villains. Don't worry about that. James Bond. Do you know what? I think it's time to sort of modernise James Bond.
Katie McCabe.
It's Katie McCabe. I think James Bond needs to be sort of suave, well-dressed. But what if he was quite a progressive guy as well after all this time? I think if we could get him back from loan, Hector Bellerin.
As James Bond. Yeah. I'd love James
Complete
Bond
with accent.
With the accent. You know. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. but imagine the suits. He'd really look the part, you know?
Yeah. Like Willy Wonka.
Have you got an alternative? Or?
Just trying to think from the current squad. I mean, could Kieran Tierney do an homage to Sean Connery?
Connery, yeah, maybe.
Do we have any Irishman who could do a Pierce Brosnan? Not sure we do.
I don't, actually, sadly.
I think if you could channel an Ainsley Maitland-Niles penalty into the character of James Bond, like one of those cold-as-ice little chips, you know, down the middle, Iceman penalty, Maitland-Niles is James Bond. How about that?
I'd like that. Yeah. I'd like that. The Birdcatcher becomes James Bond.
Yeah.
Sure.
I like it. Okay. Well, look, let's leave it there. There is still an interlull. We don't play again until Monday, so we're going to have to do next week's Arscast Extra on a Tuesday.
Okay. Good idea.
Yeah, good idea, because we'll know what's happened in the game against...
Yeah, that'll be easier than just guessing, to be honest with you.
Yeah. When we come face-to-face
never goes
with
well.
Patrick Vieira, of course. So that's an interesting dynamic to that. But look, we'll talk more about that during the week. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you, as always, for being here and for listening. And goodbye, I think, is what I'm trying to say here. We'll catch you on the next
one. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.